This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Saturday, February 11th, 2023. I'm Jared Halpern. The State of the Union was rowdy Tuesday night.
I'm not politely not naming them, but it's being proposed by some of you. Look,
I'm Kevin Cork. An unflinching examination of real power behind the veil in Washington. But the question remains, even if the GOP-led House Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government exposes unmistakable corruption, will anything come of it?
What can any congressional investigator do to sort of put the fear of God in the FBI? And I don't know. We've yet to find out.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. As far as a Tuesday night in the chamber of the House of Representatives goes, the State of the Union address was a scene.
I'm not politely not naming them, but it's being proposed by some of you. Look, folks.
Yeah. President Biden got a rise from Republicans and was called liar after suggesting GOP lawmakers intend to cut Social Security and Medicare as part of spending cuts and deficit reduction.
As we all apparently agree, Social Security and Medicare is off the books now, right? They're not to be stopped.
Of course, the national debt wasn't the only, pardon the pun, ballooning issue raising bipartisan concerns this week. Congress got new information about the Chinese spy balloon shot down over the waters of South Carolina. It is serving the fast-track debate over new safeguards against Chinese espionage in a popular social media app. My colleague on Capitol Hill, Fox's senior congressional correspondent Chad Pergram, shares his reporting on the speech, the balloon, and what happens next.
Well, I think the president actually kind of liked the give and take, not that it was a polite give and take, but kind of like the sparring, frankly, a little bit, because, if you talk to Democrats and you talk to people at the White House, they will tell you they think that there are certain extremist hardliners in the Republican Party. Their manners are not always Emily Post, certainly for a State of the Union. And this impolitesse presentation that they present, I think he's kind of like, okay, we're not going to stoop to their level, but we're going to meet them at their level. If they're going to kind of heckle me from the dais, I'm going to kind of go back and forth with them a little bit, you know. I had asked Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, if he had spoken with Speaker McCarthy about this and whether that sort of conduct was appropriate and whether or not the Speaker should have been more aggressive in maybe maintaining decorum inside the House chamber. And he completely sidestepped my question there. He had not spoken to the Speaker about it, but didn't respond to the part about whether or not Speaker McCarthy should have been more aggressive in imposing order inside the House chamber. There was one point where McCarthy kind of looked off to the side and kind of, you know, imagine like being, you know, a parent, you know, over here.
Yeah, no, I know that
church,
look.
You know, shush. You know. That was just about it. Yeah, you've probably done that, right, Jared? So that was one part of it. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who called the president a liar, she indicated that she said, well, that's what, you know, I'm speaking for my constituents. That's kind of how they feel. She said, you know, and Speaker McCarthy has not indicated that he has any displeasure with me. This is the problem that Kevin McCarthy has with his conference, is that he has to kind of let them be what they're going to be, and that's what they are. And some people will question whether or not that's the right thing to do, that, you know, if he should be a little more aggressive with them. And that was my question to Hakeem Jeffries. But the second part of it is, you know, the Democrats probably just lap this up because they say, hey, this looks like the Republicans are way up in the deep end here. They come up with these crazy ideas, them speaking here. And the face of the party is Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. And meantime, Kevin McCarthy is trying to govern. I mean, Greene said that she was not hectored or was not goaded into this hectoring that was going on. I mean, McCarthy went on our air the morning after State of the Union and said, well, the president was trying to kind of, goad them into this. And it's kind of like when you play basketball, you know who the hotheads are on the other team and you compel them to take a technical foul or something.
Sure.
Marjorie Taylor Greene said constituents are fed up. And she said, we settled that on the House floor, is what she said.
And listen, maybe they did, because the president and the White House has been saying for weeks that Republicans are going to cut Social Security and Medicare as part of a deficit reduction plan, debt limit deal, which is something that the speaker himself has repeatedly said we're not going to do. And that seems to be a frustration, and to some observers, a fair frustration on the part of Republicans that the president keeps repeating this line.
Well, until Republicans actually show what they're for cutting. You know, this is why Democrats were willing to say this, because if you say you're going to balance the budget and if you understand the math of the budget and the idea that Medicare, Medicaid and Social Security entitlements comprise 64, 66, almost 70% of all federal spending. And granted, Medicaid is something they have apparently put on the table, because both sides have said Medicare and Social Security are off the table. Yeah. Medicaid is what they don't kind of talk about here, but still, that's about 40%. Of all federal spending, then if you don't have a concrete plan, the only way you can balance the budget or even make a dent in some of this spending is to address those programs. So that gives Democrats an opportunity to go into this. And they're supposed to put out a budget, the Republicans in the House in March. They're supposed to pass it by the middle of April. It's going to be fascinating to see if they can do that and then what's in it, because that will be their plan.
Well, and so that was what I was going to get to, because this is all obviously tied to these ongoing talks about raising the debt limit. Republicans insist that any debt limit raise has to be done with spending reforms. The next step in these negotiations between the president and the speaker will play out in March, right? The president is delivering his budget, I think, on March 9th, certainly by the first week of March, second week of March. To your point, Republicans in the House will deliver theirs around the same time. That's then when, like, these negotiations can begin, right? Then we have, like, a plan. What's the revenue side for the president? What's the cutting side for Republicans? And we go from there.
And keep in mind, whatever the Republicans come up with, that doesn't actually have to add up. Budgets are kind of a glorified press release.
But that's the first time that we get a sense of, like, what these proposals are, right?
It is. And this is where it gets very interesting. I'm going to tell you a little story here. So some years ago, when Republicans were first in control of the House in 2011, after they gotten it back, and you had Paul Ryan putting together then the Budget Committee chairman, the vaunted Ryan budget, which had a lot of criticism from the Democrats because it cut Obamacare, but it counted the tax revenue from Obamacare toward deficit reduction, which obviously you can't have it both ways, that sort of thing. There was a lot of that in there, which is why I'm saying that these things don't actually have to balance and the numbers don't actually have to add up. So when you put budgets on the floor, you do this with a pretty open process. You know, this was something that Kevin McCarthy, we're not going to lock down the rules and how what amendments and proposals can be considered on the floor, something central to him winning the speakership. So you had the Ryan budget, and then you had something that was even more conservative than that. You had the Republican Study Committee, which is the biggest block of conservatives in the House, and they wanted to go even further. But, everybody was like, yeah, we're going to pass the Ryan budget. So the Democrats specifically withheld their votes. And what you do on the floor when you consider a budget, you consider each of these proposed budgets, like the Congressional Black Caucus had a budget, the Blue Dogs, the moderate Democrats had a budget. And you consider them what we call here on the Hill in the nature of a substitute, meaning they're a substitute amendment to the base budget. But if you ever adopt a substitute amendment, you stop, because they're like, well, you passed that in lieu of the other thing. So that's the thing now, if that makes sense. So the Democrats withheld their votes, and the House almost adopted the more conservative budget, because Democrats laid this trap to say, we want to show you how extreme they are. So when Kevin McCarthy is going to get these proposals on what this budget is going to look like, are they going to put out a budget that might get into Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security? Could that be adopted on the fly on the House floor? If he is going to be true to his word about how they're going to do this on the floor, you don't really know. And that could happen and surprise some people if that comes to pass. And then Democrats will say, hey, this is what we told you about. Again, that still has to happen.
So
we'll see.
But
that will be drama. That's right. Yeah. Probably March, and April, so, you know, May. They don't really, you know, again, you.
Yeah, I know that you're, like, by statute, the president was supposed to have already, you know, delivered
this.
And
yes.
There's no budget police that arrest you for, yeah.
It doesn't matter. You know, it's like spring training games, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right, right. So let's talk about the other big story on the Hill this week, this balloon, this Chinese spy balloon shot down over the weekend by a fighter jet. I know Congress is just now starting to learn a little bit more about this balloon, about the decision-making process, about larger issues as it relates to China. This comes at a time where there is already a lot of bipartisan concern about the influence of China. Does this speed up those types of hearings, those types of legislative approaches that are on the table?
Well, let's see what the legislation actually is. They've not passed anything yet. We do have this new China committee here.
Yeah.
On its face, yes. But you see potential for bipartisan agreement on this because, you know, maybe we're back to the old adage of that, you know, foreign policy stops at the water's edge. Well, and
there has been some bipartisan.
The adversary. Right.
You look at like TikTok and things like that, right, which is the Chinese own. And Congress has been very hardline against TikTok, accusing it of being sort of this social media spy platform. You can't, it's banned now on federal devices.
Don't look up, look down at your phone, in other words.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, so could Congress go further and like ban TikTok in the United States, like on everybody's devices?
Here's the problem with that. And this is something I did a lot of reporting on. Back in the 1970s, Congress passed a bill, law, that basically wanted to crack down on our foreign adversaries and didn't want Americans helping our foreign adversaries. And what they found, though, it was a problem that you had publishers and people who made films and things, dissidents in countries which were opposed to the United States, the former Soviet Union or other communist places or whatnot. And that provision, because you had people in the United States who were trying to get their message out. In other words, you know, they would help them publish or help them get their film on the screen or TV show or something. And, you know, again, we didn't have the internet in the 70s and the 80s. And so this was a limitation. And so Howard Berman, who is now a former Democratic congressman from California, he drafted the Berman Amendment. And the Berman Amendment did a carve out for just that. So when you're dealing with issues of free speech, you have a safe harbor for those types of things because you have people trying to produce these messages and we don't want to clamp down on them. That's a bad look for the United States. And it does not help the global cause or the United States cause around the world. They would probably have to repeal the Berman Amendment to take down TikTok and ban it in the United States. A lot of people haven't thought that out that far yet. You're hearing that here first. That's a newsflash. So that's something that you might hear more about. And again, you have different viewpoints on how far they should go with TikTok. Nobody has come up with a piece of legislation that everybody says, yes, this is the approach on China. Look at all the differences that people have put forth on how we should have handled the balloon. You have some people say, yes, we should have shot it down before it got to Montana. We have people that say that Lisa Murkowski was apoplectic, saying she was just mad as hell, the fact that it was allowed to, you know, float over the Aleutian chain. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. If you shoot it down on American soil, everybody was saying, okay, it might hit something, but you also don't, A, know what's in it. Does it have a self-destruct device in there? You know, I always remember, you know, the opening scene in the Empire Strikes Back, and there's a Empire probe droid that comes down on Hoth, if you remember this, and Han Solo shoots it, and he's like, I didn't hit it that hard. And he said, but I bet you know the Empire knows we're here now. You know, great, I shot the thing up. So you want this, you want to try to recover this thing. So if it were to crash to the Earth, there might be toxic chemicals there. Does it explode on its own? And then we don't get the technology. So by shooting it down off the coast actually gives you maybe a little bit more of an opportunity to see what they have and see what data that was collected. And if you shot it down off the coast of Alaska, you know, we are talking about territorial waters here, which extend 12 nautical miles off the coast. So if they shot it down somewhere outside that, then you have an international incident. You know, it's not something within U.S. proper. That's an issue. So, you know, you can't get 535 people to agree even on how they should have handled this, let alone what they should do about TikTok.
But those debates and like this committee, it's going to take on some new urgency, I would think.
Yes, certainly. You know, you're going to hear more about that than almost any other issue in the Congress this year when it comes to foreign policy, probably more so than Ukraine, maybe even more so than the border, which they had their first, you know, big hearing on that with the Border Patrol agents this week. But, yeah, I mean, this is front and center. And you know why this is front and center now? It's a couple of reasons. Number one, and I've likened this to what happened with Sputnik in 1957. Americans could go out at night and see this thing floating overhead, and A, were freaked out by it. And people then realized, oh, we're behind in the space race. They are eating our lunch over there, or maybe in the vernacular, drinking our Tang. I don't know. But they, you know, you had Dwight Eisenhower at that point. Congress rushed through an approval to create NASA. That happened in 1958, so right after Sputnik. You had DARPA, which is the defense, you know, research arm at the Pentagon, which is always making up new fantastical devices and computer programs and everything else. They were put together around that same time period, 1958, 59, 60. You know, John Kennedy then, when he took office in 1961, said that, you know, whoever controls outer space, you know, controls the Earth. And so there was, you know, an implicit move by the United States to get on the case here. And so you could see a moment, a seminal moment here in the United States where we've changed the paradigm, that average Americans in Montana are looking up in the sky and saying, here they come. What are we going to do about it? There is this is why this was an important moment right here the past week in the United States when it comes to China.
And it's going to continue to be. These briefings and hearings are certainly going to continue as Congress demands answers and, to your point, tries to maybe craft a response. So we'll look forward to those conversations as well. Chad Pergram, a pleasure as always.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This week, big tech was on trial in front of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee for turning a blind eye to the Hunter Biden laptop story. Former Twitter executives testified for the first time about the company's decision in the weeks before the 2020 election to initially block the Hunter Biden laptop story from Twitter. GOP lawmakers allege that the nation's intel agencies and the FBI in particular are being weaponized to target everyday Americans. Enter the House Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, a Republican-led charge to put the agencies under scrutiny and expose, they say, an abuse of power pattern that undermines democracy. But will it amount to anything? Chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and Fox News contributor Byron York isn't so sure.
Republicans in the House were stung during the Trump years by a couple of things that happened. First was the FBI's so-called collusion investigation, Crossfire Hurricane, which the FBI began in 2016 to investigate the Trump campaign at the time. As you know, the collusion investigation went on for years, later under a special counsel who could never establish that collusion had actually taken place. So a lot of bad feelings among Republicans about that. And then in 2020, both of these are campaign-related events. In 2020, there was the Twitter's suppression, censorship of the Hunter Biden story in the New York Post. And the reason they're included in this is that we later learn that the FBI has been briefing Twitter through the summer and fall of 2020.
20, alerting them to the possibility of Russian disinformation in the last days of the campaign, and specifically that it might have something to do with Hunter Biden. So the FBI kind of set Twitter up to think that perhaps this New York Post story was Russian disinformation. So Twitter censored it. And of course, it turned out to be the laptop turned out to be a genuine thing. So both of those things, without those, you would not be having a committee on the weaponization of the federal government.
Very interesting. And I found it also enlightening that Ohio Representative Jim Jordan, who, of course, chaired the first hearing, said Twitter officials had been played by the FBI. What did you make of that assessment?
Well, you know, I had had similar thoughts myself, because you probably heard of this man, Yoel Roth, who was basically Twitter's chief censor. And going into this whole story, I kind of thought that he might be the villain of the story who censors the New York Post story. And, you know, they put the New York Post in Twitter jail for weeks. They couldn't use their Twitter site. So I thought it might have been Roth. But later we learned through a couple of things. We learned through the Twitter files that Elon Musk released. And we also learned through a complaint that was launched at the Federal Election Committee against Twitter, Commission against Twitter. And we learned that Twitter had been meeting regularly, maybe weekly, and communicating even more regularly with the FBI throughout the campaign of 2020. And what Roth testified to was, he said, look, we were all shaken and scarred after the 2016 experience in which they thought that Russian interference had helped Donald Trump get elected, which was the nightmare scenario for them. So we were determined not to let that happen again in 2020. So it appears that Yoel Roth was actually acting not on the orders of the FBI, but certainly on the suggestion of the FBI. So the FBI and the government here play a bigger role in Twitter's decision than we had previously thought.
Well, that would be pernicious to basically use the arm of the federal government to, in effect, squelch free speech, would it not?
Yeah, and that's what Republicans are getting at here, which is that the First Amendment forbids the government from censoring or suppressing a journalistic enterprise, a news story like this. It's an exercise of free speech, and the federal government cannot abridge that. What Republicans believe happened was, instead of censoring Twitter itself, which it was forbidden to do, the FBI got Twitter to do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the theory. On the other hand, you know, it's not like they're going to find a letter from the director of the FBI to Twitter saying, you know, we really want to censor this story, but the First Amendment prohibits us from doing so, so we want you to do it instead. I mean, there's not that clear of a smoking gun in this case. So Republicans are always going to be able to say Democrats are always going to be able to say that Republicans really have not proven their case.
Speaking of the Democrats, I heard quite strongly many of them make the argument both at the hearing itself, but also as you watch pundits pop up on the air, they're in effect making the argument, Byron, that this really doesn't rise to the level of a national emergency. Why are we spending time on this? You heard AOC say something to that effect. You also heard them warn Republicans not to weaponize the Congress in a way that could obviously be replicated down the line. Give me your take on both of those storylines.
Yeah, well, we've seen a couple of things. Always, when one party doesn't want an investigation to take place, they always say there are more important things we should be doing.
Sure.
You know, we should be working on the economy or immigration or education or any of other things. Exactly. So that's one thing. I there were a couple of interesting protests from Democrats that I thought that one is that Jamie Raskin, who's the Democratic representative from Maryland and was a member of the January 6th committee, said, you know, Twitter was a big part of January 6th conspirators, you know, passing messages from each one to the other. And of course, President Trump at that time in December and January of 2020 and 2021 used Twitter. So we should be investigating that. Although there already has been a January 6th committee. So, I mean, those were some interesting comments. And there was one more, which is that, oh, gee, maybe we should investigate the weaponization of the FBI against Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign. And indeed, if you remember, in the last 10 days of that campaign, James Comey, who was the FBI director at that time, just kind of blew up the whole campaign for a while, saying that the FBI had reopened its investigation into the Clinton emails. And that was something that some Democrats actually blame for Clinton's loss. So, I mean, they have their own grievances against the FBI, which it almost seems to me they should both agree that we need to look into what the FBI is doing. If both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have legitimate, you know, grievances against them.
You know, Tulsi Gabbard, former congresswoman from the great state of Hawaii, who, as you know, has been fairly critical of the government because of activities like these. She has said previously that this needs a close examination, because the farther down the road we go and allowing this sort of behavior, if you believe that the FBI or other agencies are either in cahoots with big tech, if they are targeting one particular political or social persuasion over another, she has made the argument, Byron, that if we don't do something now, this will get worse. And as we've seen in Washington, sometimes memories like knives can be fairly long. What's your assessment of her perspective on this?
Yeah, I think there's actually some merit in that, because one of the arguments we were hearing, and we've heard it before, about the FBI is not that all FBI agents are really bad guys, that the majority of them are, you know, they're looking for criminals, they're looking for bad guys, they're looking for bank robbers and terrorists and kidnappers and all sorts of people who commit serious crimes. And that's a really good thing, and that's what the FBI is supposed to do. But it appears that there was this kind of hyper-politicized elite at the very, very top of FBI management in Washington, D.C., that did become more politicized, and that did get the FBI involved in political investigations that it shouldn't have been involved in. And I do, you know, I think that's a bipartisan complaint. And I think, you have to look at the 2016 campaign and you have to think, you know, both major party candidates, nominees for president, the Democratic and Republican nominees for president, were under investigation by the FBI. And so you think to yourself, well, gee, maybe they were both kind of squirrely candidates, or maybe you think maybe the FBI is overreached here and shouldn't be investigating everybody like this.
Whistleblower testimony is always provocative. I thought yesterday's in particular was worth, if you didn't want to sit there and watch this like you and I might consume all the hearings, if you just sort of popped in and popped out, I thought the whistleblower was provocative and interesting to listen to. What was your perspective as you listened to this former FBI agent describe sort of what you just laid out, this sort of shifting at the top, how what originally in her experience was one type of law enforcement organization has become to, she argues, almost a weaponized arm of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think that that should really be all that surprising to people. Institutions do change. I mean, the character of institutions change. They can move, if they're political, they can kind of move from the right to the center or the right to the left or the other way around. So I don't think it's that unusual. I know that Republicans have been pretty excited on the Hill, have been pretty excited about having actual whistleblowers in these cases, because there are a number of people from inside the FBI, either still inside or former FBI people, who do worry about the direction the Bureau has taken. So I think the whistleblower stuff is pretty effective. And also, you know, if Democrats complain about it, Republicans remind them that Democrats started a whole impeachment episode of a president based on a whistleblower. So it's a big deal.
Two last questions. One, where do we go with this? What happens? Ultimately, there's supposed to be this report that comes out in January of 2025. I just don't know that there's a lot there for the general public. Am I wrong about that? Do you think this amounts to very much?
No, I think you raise a really good question. Is all the stuff we've been talking about, we've basically known it without having a committee on the weaponization of the federal government. So is there new stuff that they're going to give us? Not just about these episodes, but totally new examples they're going to give us that will really convince everybody that this committee really was needed. And can Republicans kind of control their instinct to oversell things and keep it in perspective? I do not know the answer to that question.
Lastly, Byron York joining us. When you look at this in total, I don't want to oversell this. Anytime that a major agency like the Bureau is under extreme scrutiny, it does sort of seem to make them back off, if albeit temporarily. If you're Republicans, could that be the thinking that now that they are on notice, maybe they back off just a bit? Or will this perhaps embolden those who are in leadership to simply say, you can't lay a glove on us? I certainly saw some of that during Peter Strzok's testimony, this sort of, there's nothing you can do. We're going to do what we've always done. And we believe very forcefully that we are working on behalf of the good of this country, therefore. What do you think of that thought?
You know, I would say that your first option, you know, that the FBI would back off and they'd really become more chastened about this. I mean, it sounds good, but I think your second scenario might be correct. I know when I was reporting in 2017, 18, 19, as the House Intelligence Committee was trying to find out what the FBI and other parts of the intelligence community had done in the Trump investigation, I mean, they were totally stonewalled. And this was a Republican committee. It was led by Devin Nunes at the time. Republican-led House committee with a Republican administration, Republican president. And the FBI just told them to get lost. I mean, they really stonewalled them on a lot of occasions. And that is a common feature with the FBI. And I'm I guess the bigger part of your question is, what can any congressional investigator do to sort of put the fear of God in the FBI? And I don't know. We've yet to find out.
Yeah, have not seen that, at least not yet. The great Byron York, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Artificial intelligence is becoming more capable and now even contributing to congressional speeches. We'll speak to a lawmaker about what Congress can do to regulate the advancing technology before it's too late. And the Democratic National Committee has voted to change up its presidential primary calendar. Well, doing so upset voters in key states. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.